phone background here.
Senate Judiciary, be in order, please. Secretary, take the roll.
Vice Chair McGilvery? Vice Chair Sands?
Here.
Senator Esp?
Here.
Senator Heinbaugh?
Here.
Senator Bennett?
Here.
Senator Manzella?
Here.
Senator Weber?
Here.
Senator Brown?
Here.
Senator Friedel?
Here.
Senator Gross?
Here.
Chairman Regeer?
Here. Committee, we have four bills that we're going to hear today, and then we'll do executive action. Those of you in Zoom land, executive action will be on Senate Bill 219, 219, and Senate Bill 223, 223. Committee members, you should have received a fiscal note for Senate Bill 200, that was Revised Uniform Real Property Transfer on Death Act that Senator Sands brought. That bill has still been on our status sheet. Now that the fiscal note has come, it will head on down the path. Okay. With that, we will start today with Senate Bill 240. Senator, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of Judiciary. It's good to be before you today. I am Teresa Manzella, representing Senate District 44, which is the north end of the beautiful Bitterroot Valley. And for your consideration today, I bring a very simple one-page bill, Senate Bill 240. And we call this the Felony False Reporting Bill. And it just seeks to do one thing, and that is to add a penalty for felony false reporting to law enforcement officers. And you might wonder if this is necessary, and my response is yes, it definitely is. The criminals are getting smarter and the crimes are getting more elaborate, and I would like to share just one real quick example with you. This particular instance was publicly recognized across the United States. There was an actor in Illinois indicted February 19th of the year 2019 for 16 counts of disorderly conduct for allegedly staging a fake hate crime assault. And he claimed that two white men wearing political gear used their hands and their feet and teeth as weapons. They spewed racial and homophobic slurs, poured an unknown chemical substance, possibly bleach, on him and tied a noose around his neck. Through the investigation, it was determined that the person reporting the crime actually paid two brothers $3,500 to stage the attack. In February 2019, he was arrested, but in March, charges were dropped by the Cook County State's Attorney. And he was given community service and forfeited his $10,000 bond. That angered the city officials that the penalty was so lenient. So they took up the case themselves and filed a lawsuit in circuit court against the false reporter for the cost of the overtime that the authorities expended in investigating the alleged attack, which amounted to over $130,000, and they spent 5 months investigating and put 12 detectives on the case. So that was an extensive use of resources, taxpayer dollars, for a false report. Later, the suspect countersued, claiming that he was the victim of mass public ridicule and harm, which of course he created himself. In February of 2020, after further investigation by a special prosecutor, the suspect went before a grand jury and was charged with six counts pertaining to making four false police reports, six felony counts of disorderly conduct. And so can you even imagine? I mean, that was almost a year, 11 months of investigating was just spent on this one crime of false reporting. So there are 18 states that have implemented some level of felony false reporting. And I think that with that, I will simply sit down and allow the proponents and opponents to testify. And I reserve the right to close, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Are there any proponents in the room? Proponents.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dan Smith, S-M-I-T-H, and I'm here representing the Montana Police Protective Association, which covers 21 police departments and nearly 700 police officers throughout the state. We are here in support of this bill. This bill makes great sense. As a retired member of law enforcement, I've worked in three different jurisdictions here in the state of Montana. And the thing that I like about this bill the most is the punishment is commensurate with the crime. So if the lie is about a misdemeanor offense, it stays a misdemeanor. But if the lie is about a felony, it takes it to the felony level. And this is important because I think that we have wasted a lot of time and resources over the years on lies in felony cases that take up a great deal of time and effort from our police departments. I would also like to point out there is also great discretion from police officers and prosecutors when they charge this crime. It's, sometimes a victim of a partner family member assault will lie to put herself in a safe spot. And many times that crime is not charged, and that would be a misdemeanor crime anyway. But when somebody lies about a felony offense, such as a homicide or a sexual assault, where it puts that person that they're lying about in grave danger of losing their livelihood and their reputation, the person that lied about that should be held accountable for what it's doing to the other person. So I would urge your support, and I thank you for your time.
I neglected to remind people to turn their cell phones off if they're here. And when you do testify, whether you're online or in person, give us your first and last name and spell your last name. Any other proponents?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Alan Doan, D-O-A-N-E, here today from the Montana Department of Justice. We support this bill for the reasons previously stated. I'd also like to point out on line 13, the word knowingly remains in the bill. That's a high threshold, and if someone does cross that threshold, the punishment would meet the crime. Thank you.
Any other proponents in the room?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Scott Burlingham, B-U-R-L-I-N-G. H-A-M. Mr. Chairman, I have a handout for the committee.
Fine. Give it to the secretary.
Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I am not a politician, okay? I'm a professional law enforcement officer. That's who I am. This is only the second time that I've given testimony to legislature. In the last session, I testified in favor of changing the penalties for knowingly reporting a false crime to law enforcement authorities. Unfortunately, the measure was vetoed by then-Governor Bullock. Today, to speak in favor of Senate Bill 240, and I'm hoping for a more favorable outcome. I have served in law enforcement in Montana for the last 30 years. All of that time has been in Ravalli County. I know what's happening out across the state. I talk to other investigators almost on a daily basis, so I can give you up-to-date and relevant information about this issue. I have watched my community slowly evolve over the years. In some ways, it's been very good, and in some ways, it's been bad. Currently, MCA 45-7205, false reports to law enforcement authorities, reads in part that in order for it to be found guilty, a person must knowingly give false information to a law enforcement authority. I won't read the entire code because you can access and read it yourself. The changes that I'm asking for, we're asking for, are very, very simple. Law enforcement authorities would be changed to peace officer. That's defined in the code. The penalty for knowingly making a false report would also be changed. It would be, if the crime falsely reported was a misdemeanor, the suspect could be sentenced to not more than 6 months in the county jail or fined not more than $500 or both. If the crime falsely reported was a felony, the suspect could be sentenced to not more than 4 years in the state prison or fined not more than $10,000 or both. Under the current law, a person can knowingly make a false report and accuse someone of the most heinous and ugly felony crimes imaginable. If prosecuted, they currently can only be charged with a misdemeanor. That needs to change. SB 240 is short and succinct. If a person knowingly reports a false misdemeanor crime, they could be charged with a misdemeanor. If the person knowingly reports a false felony crime, they could be charged with a felony. The key word is knowingly. It's that simple. And when I say simple, I mean simple wording in the law. As far as proving knowingly, I'm prepared to meet that threshold. And I've talked to many other officers across the state who they're not worried about meeting that threshold. They feel they can do that and have in the past. The definition of a peace officer and knowingly are located in general description section in 45-2101 MCA. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, during my testimony in the last legislative session, I gave examples of people who staged fake crimes and knowingly made false reports to law enforcement authorities. I've added those reports to the written testimony I have submitted here today, but for the sake of brevity, I would direct your attention to only the first example. If you are interested in the others, please read those on your own. Example, robbery, assault with a weapon, and kidnapping. This really happens. It happened then, and it continues to happen. Officers from multiple agencies respond at speed. And when I say at speed, they're going cold. They're moving along. They're putting people in danger and themselves in danger. They're responding at speed to lights and sirens after our 911 center received a call from an employee of a local restaurant and casino. When officers arrived, they cleared the building and the surrounding area at gunpoint. That's standard procedure. The officers found the employee bound to a rail in the casino portion of the business. The worker reported that while she was closing the business for the night, she was confronted by an unknown male suspect who was armed with a handgun. The employee told the officers the suspect pushed her into the restaurant area and first forced her to open the business safe at gunpoint. According to the employee, the suspect took approximately $15,000 in cash and checks. The employee reported that the suspect tied her to the metal rail and fled on foot. The employee gave the officers a detailed description of the suspect. The employee told the officers that after a time, she was able to reach her cell phone and able to call 911. The description of the suspect and the information that that he was armed with a handgun was transmitted to all law enforcement officers in the county. Additionally, the suspect description was given to law enforcement in the surrounding counties. For the next several weeks, a detective investigated this felony report. After a lengthy investigation, it was discovered that the reporting female and her boyfriend had staged a robbery and had taken the money for their own benefit. The person made a false report of felony crimes to law enforcement, knowing that the crimes had not committed. In doing so, the female employee put many people at risk, including the officer responding to the scene at high speeds and other motorists on the road. Additionally, while some officers responded to the scene others search the area for the suspect. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, false reports are where a weapon is said to have been used or brandished bring a higher level of danger in response to and from law enforcement. If officers find a person near the crime scene who matches the description of the suspect, they will conduct a felony stop, which includes officers pulling their weapon while the threat is assessed. When people make false reports, they put other people and put everyone at risk. Those in opposition to SB 240 will say that if it passes, victims of sexual or physical violence will be scared to report crimes in fear of getting in trouble. Nothing could be farther from the truth. In Montana today, law enforcement works hand-in-hand with many of the victim advocacy groups. Our investigation of crimes against women and children are stronger and more intense than ever before. A full two-thirds of my detectives division are assigned to investigate sexual and violent assault crimes. Those investigators are top-notch. They are dedicated professionals and are absolutely second to none. Their lives away from their home, I'm just thinking of one that I know of. He borderlines obsession about solving these crimes. He works just intensely. He's professional. While we have a duty to bring offenders to justice, we also have a responsibility to see that those who are falsely accused are vindicated. Through my career, I have seen the pain and destruction that happens when people are falsely accused, and it happens. When people jump to conclusions, lives, careers, and family are threatened, and good people are damaged. I am a gentle and forgiving person. There is a need for compassion and understanding, especially in law enforcement. Officer and prosecutorial discretion is used on a daily basis, and where it is appropriate, I encourage it. Just imagine if you got pulled over for doing something, a minor infraction. The officer, they use discretion every day. We all do. Prosecutors, discretion. To those who oppose SB 240, I say we'll just have to agree to disagree. It is my professional opinion that if we really want to stop sexual or physical assault, then we need to step up prosecution and conviction of the offenders. More importantly, we need to hold offenders accountable for their crimes, which means they may be imprisoned. Our laws are designed to bring offenders to justice, not to hold the accused hostage. When society knows there are substantial consequences for committing a crime, it serves as a deterrent. Please note, and this is very important, the law says knowingly, not mistakenly. That is a high threshold that we all have to prove. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I put my contact information on the bottom of this written statement. If you have any questions, please feel free to call me at any time. Thank you.
Any other proponents in the room?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Brian Thompson. That is T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N. I'm on here on behalf of two organizations this morning. That would be the Montana County Attorneys Association, as well as the Montana Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, supporting this bill. I think the other proponents and the sponsor have done a good job of presenting this bill and what it does. As a little bit of history, Senator Manziel had brought in this bill last year and worked with us to get it into the form it's in today now, and we stand here in support of that bill. To talk about the process a little bit, remember that to be convicted of a crime, it takes a proving of fact to be determined by the jury beyond a reasonable doubt of two factors here in this bill. and that would be knowingly false. If the person is lying, and they knew they were lying, that's when this statute comes into effect. It doesn't come into effect in a good faith reporting where they were mistaken. We think that this is a good bill, a good change, and puts teeth in the punishment for intentional wrong acts. Thank you very much.
Any other proponents in the room? Proponents in the room. Okay, there are none online. Any opponents in the room? Opponents to 240.
Chairman Regeer, members of the committee, Sam Forstag, F-O-R-S-T-A-G, here on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union of Montana. We rise in opposition to Senate Bill 240, and in brief, we are considering implementing significant new criminal penalties in any section of code. That's something we should proceed with carefully. And in the context of this crime, some of you heard from me last session on behalf of student organizations talking about sexual assault and the crisis that we recently dealt with in our state. You know, for many crimes, the issue is not false reporting. Overwhelmingly, the issue is underreporting. And when we already have criminal penalties in effect, I ask you to consider whether passing this bill will do good to solve the overwhelming issue of crimes like sexual assault that are underreported, that face all sorts of social barriers to being reported, and what sort of chilling effect this will have on those people who already so often do not feel comfortable or safe going to police to report those crimes. Did you cut me off, Mr. Chair?
It seemed to cut out. You're okay now. Go ahead.
I didn't think I was too long just yet. I do stand ready for questioning, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Any other opponents in the room?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, S.J. Howell, H-O-W-E-L-L, here with Montana Women Vote. I want to be really brief. I think you're going to hear some substantive opponents online. We respectfully think this is an unnecessary addition to the criminal code, and we agree with Mr. Forstag that it does seem like it would have implications for already concerning rates of underreporting, particularly in sexual assault. And I would just also note, in a year where we're having tough conversations about our budget, that we think this would bring pretty significant additional costs, both in terms of court costs and incarceration costs. So we respectfully urge a no vote. Thank you.
Any other opponents in the room? Opponents in the room? Online, Robin Turner.
Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
We can. Very well. Go ahead.
Thank you. This is my first online testimony, so I appreciate your patience. My name is Robin Turner. I work for Reese Law Group, which is a law firm in Missoula, Montana. My last name is spelled T-U-R-N-E-R. Some of you may remember me. I was policy director at the Montana Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence for a few years. I left a couple of years ago to go into private practice. My practice now is primarily focused on serving survivors of domestic and sexual violence in family law cases, orders of protection, educational advocacy, crime victims' rights. So I rise in opposition to this bill, and I would ask that this committee reject it. One of the proponents for this bill talked about how important it was to create deterrence to false reporting. Sexual assault survivors and domestic violence survivors, particularly child survivors of both of those crimes, do not need additional deterrence or barriers to reporting these crimes. I'm sure that those of you who have been in the legislature for a while, who worked on changing our sexual assault consent bill a few sessions ago, understand that there are already a lot of barriers for survivors in reporting. Survivors are afraid to report. They're afraid to report when it involves someone they know, someone they trust, someone they're married to, someone who's the parent of their children. Survivors are afraid to report when it's their parent who's committing the harm, or their parent's friend, or someone that's in a trusted position. But we also know that many of those crimes, many sexual assault crimes, in fact, the majority of them, are committed against by people that the survivor knows. And so it's important to understand that survivors don't need another barrier. Survivors also go through a lot when they report a crime. I don't want to speak too specifically about it because I want to recognize that it can be a challenging thing to remember, but the process of investigating a sexual crime is incredibly invasive. It requires a full medical exam. It requires a police interview when a survivor has just experienced a great trauma. Some law enforcement officers are learning how to better interview survivors, but it's true that survivors are in the middle of a really traumatic event. They're expected to provide evidence from their actual body, and they go through an adversarial process from the get-go. Unfortunately, survivors often, their only option to get medical care or treatment is to engage in the criminal justice system when they don't really want to, because it can be harmful. As a survivor's rights attorney, I have had to draft briefs restricting the full sharing of a survivor's lifetime medical records. I've had to fight scurrilous accusations of drug use of a survivor in family law matters. I have a wide variety of ways that survivors are harmed when they engage in the system. And so even the threat of a felony prosecution for false reporting is going to just add to the harm that survivors experience. You know, I definitely agree that law enforcement and prosecutors are learning more and more about the trauma and harm that survivors experience when they are assaulted, and when they're experiencing that trauma. I'm working with agencies to make sure that survivors' voices are heard on that. But I will say that there's still a misunderstanding of how survivors experience trauma, and the behaviors of survivors right after they experience trauma, given the hormones that are dumped in our brains after we experience that trauma. And so I would be very concerned that a misunderstanding of the way a survivor experiences the harm and the way a survivor chooses to go about reporting the crime or chooses to go about protecting themselves could create more criminal justice consequences. What survivors need is someone to listen to them. They need medical care. They need support. And they need to be able to have their voice heard and make choices about what happens to them. They don't need additional threats of prosecution, including extensive felony consequences for reporting a crime. Sometimes survivors have to report because there's no other thing that they can do and they don't feel safe. They don't need this risk and they don't need this threat. What they need is understanding and services. And so for those reasons, I rise in opposition to this bill. Thank you.
Next, Kelson Young.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, Kelson Young with the Montana Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. I'm very happy to be joining my colleague Robin Turner this morning in opposing this bill. As you heard, Senate Bill 240 mirrors House Bill 238 from last session. And as you heard from proponent testimony, I think they covered the proposal in depth in terms of the structure and detail. I'm happy to hear that we can agree to disagree this session. The reality is, for us, there is nothing black and white about sexual and domestic violence. There's only gray. So in the same way that we trust that there are, in fact, law enforcement officers and prosecutors across the state who would and are able to handle sexual and domestic violence cases very well and do what some of the proponents described, we also know that that's not true for all law enforcement and all prosecutors, especially, in fact, in those rare circumstances where it is a law enforcement officer who is the perpetrator. So we're here to talk for the survivors who are underrepresented in our conversations, the one who are, in fact, already strongly disenfranchised and discouraged from reporting. The other thing you'll hear from other opponents, Mr. Chairman, is that the real life circumstances of what is true in domestic and sexual violence victims is also not black and white. So we search for truth in our justice system, but so much of what happens in domestic and sexual violence is in some way subjective. And there are so many reasons why a survivor's story might not be believed. Why, as you heard from Robin Turner, why a survivor's story changes. It's because of the trauma. It's because of the fear. It's because they are literally making decisions, calculated decisions about how to save their lives. And so as much as this seems like a black and white proposal about holding people who are wasting the resources of law enforcement, this is really about the large number of people who interact with our criminal justice system because of violence when met within their relationships. We understand that you want to be able to hold offenders accountable, like the scenarios that you heard. We are not talking about someone who stages an elaborate plot to SWAT law enforcement against someone. The reality is those cases are rare. What happens every day in Montana is domestic and sexual violence survivors have to decide whether or not to come forward. And threats of felony penalties are just completely unacceptable, Mr. Chairman. So in addition to the other opponent testimony you'll hear, we just strongly urge you to understand that this is a complex issue, and we feel like existing penalties are sufficient. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, Erica Coyle.
Hello, members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to speak against this bill today. My name is Erica Aites Coyle, and for the record, the last name is spelled C-O-Y-L-E. And I am the executive director of Haven, the nonprofit serving survivors of intimate partner violence in Gallatin County. For those who have not experienced relationship violence firsthand, it may be tempting to believe that the only type of abuse tactics violent partners use are physical ones. In fact, physical violence is only a small piece of an abuser's strategy in gaining and maintaining power and control over their partner. Abusers also use intimidation, emotional abuse, economic abuse, and threats to keep their partner feeling as though they cannot leave the relationship. It is this last tactic, threats, that I want to speak to today. What SB 240 does is support a common threat abusers make, that law enforcement will not believe their victim's history of abuse, and that they themselves will actually charge them with a crime. In my 8 years at Haven, our organization has worked with thousands of survivors. In all of those years, I cannot recall a single case in which a survivor did not feel some apprehension about reporting their abuse to law enforcement. Sometimes, the fear they experience is fear of retribution from their partner. Other times, it is the fear of simply not being believed. By adding on the threat of being charged with false reporting, that fear will become insurmountable in some cases. I understand that this bill would require evidence to support a conviction of a false report, and that the likelihood of a survivor being convicted is, hopefully, low. However, what this bill communicates is that law enforcement does not start by believing survivors. A study of 812 sexual assault reports found a false reporting rate of only 2.1%. Meanwhile, the Bureau of Justice Statistics found that only about half of all intimate partner violence cases are ever reported. If the goal of this bill is to increase reports of actual crimes, we might best spend our efforts on making reporting easier for victims rather than creating one more barrier. Thank you.
Next, Benjamin Halverson.
Good morning, Chair. Can you hear me?
Very good. Go ahead.
Chairman Regeer, members of the committee, my name is Benjamin Halverson. I spell that H-A-L-V-E-R-S-O-N. I am the domestic violence prosecutor for the city of Billings. I typically prosecute about 600 to 800 cases a year. Last year, I prosecuted 1,200 cases. Typically, I appear before this committee and have in the past in conjunction with law enforcement in support of increased penalties, especially with regard to domestic violence. Here, I rise as a reluctant opponent this proposal, but more to explain the practical consequences to victims that have not previously been stated. So I just want to say, Chairman Greer and members of the committee, that false reporting is no doubt a serious problem. It is a tremendous waste of resources for law enforcement. And using law enforcement to incarcerate someone based on a personal dispute, it's a serious offense that demands serious consequences. However, many of the abusers I prosecute are remarkably intelligent and manipulative. Unfortunately, they rarely use these powers for good. Instead, they deploy a wide range of advanced tactics to manipulate or intimidate their abusers. And some of those examples, which I've submitted to the committee in three different letters written by victims, will make a victim submit a notarized statement providing a line-by-line recant of an original report. Abusers will threaten victims with reporting addiction issues, whether they exist or not, and to law enforcement or child protective services. In one instance, in a case I prosecuted, a victim very aggressively tried to get charges against her husband dropped. When she was unsuccessful, he held a knife to her throat and forced her to recant in writing. So those recants are almost always have more to them than they appear on the surface. But law enforcement may not always know the reasons for those recants. And if we don't know, and we are counting on the victim to tell us, which rarely happens, we are left only with what we know, which is that a victim may have filed a false police report. So as far as the City of Billings and local law enforcement is concerned, charging a victim with false police reporting is and should be an extremely a remedy in only extremely obvious circumstances. Those where a suspect had a complete alibi, victim had no injuries, changed her statement in a way that improved a criminal case after the fact. In one case that I ended up referring for prosecution to the county attorney's office, a victim falsely claimed to have been kidnapped by her boyfriend and fabricated a number of documents in support of that kidnapping. Now, that is appropriately charged as evidence tampering or witness tampering, two statutes that currently carry 10-year prison sentences, which is appropriate in those circumstances. They wasted a tremendous amount of time, and as previous proponents stated, the risk to law enforcement in those situations with firearms and potential injury or death from a victim requires a tremendous resources and response. So I will close by saying I am particularly sensitive to the incredible demands placed on law enforcement, particularly in the City of Billings. We had 1,200 misdemeanor cases of domestic violence in 2020. Those dynamics in misdemeanor and felony cases are exactly the same. We do not have the time, resources, or energy to accept the additional burden of false police reports. With that said, these incidents are incredibly rare. When they do happen, they're so obvious that existing statutes can already punish those acts as felonies. I'd ask the committee to consider the chilling effect that such a prosecution would have on a victim, particularly if it occurs at the behest of an abuser. It's an ultimate show of power and control that can be exerted if a victim knows that not only will law enforcement be unable to help her, but that she herself may also be incarcerated because of the acts of her abuser. And with that, I will stand by for questions. Thank you.
Next, Ann Truesdell.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for giving me time to voice our opposition today. My name is Ann Truesdell. That's T-R-U-E-S-D-E-L-L. And I'm here as the executive director of the Montana chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. We are a membership association representing social workers and the people that they serve. And so today we are here in opposition, and we are going to focus on the negative impact that this will have on victims of domestic and sexual violence. And I come to you with my experience as a sexual assault crisis advocate and as a therapist that worked with youth that had experienced sexual assault and sexual abuse. As an advocate, I sat with women and men that were victims of sexual assault while the medical staff checked their health, their safety, and collected evidence. I listened to their stories and everything that happened to them. I would walk them through the process of reporting and the next steps. And then later on in my career as a therapist, I worked with them through their trauma and I processed it with them. With so many of the people I sat with through that horrible experience, very few ever reported the crime of this because of the current circumstances around sexual violence in our society. Rape is already the most underreported crime, and this bill will absolutely increase the underreporting of sexual assault and child sexual abuse. Victims, especially children who have to, if they have to speak against an adult in their life, are already terrified to share their truth because they believe that no one else will believe them. I know this from years of experience, and this will increase victims' fear of reporting, and it will increase underreporting. It breaks my heart to think about the people that I have sat with through this experience and their defeat in the system that is not working for them. And I tell you, as a therapist and as a social worker, those are memories I will never be able to get rid of. And I can't imagine the impact it is still having on those people that shared their stories with me, even if they did go through the work and the trauma therapy and all the things that they did to work through their experiences. We need to break this cycle and not give it more grip on the victims that are currently experiencing this every day in Montana. We urge that you vote no on SB 240. Thank you for your time.
Next, informational witnesses in the room. Any informational witnesses? Seeing none, questions from the committee. Senator Esp.
Mr. Chairman, question probably for the sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Esp.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Manziel, I'm looking at a couple spots in the bill from line 15 to line 17. Let's take line 17 first.
Yes, sir.
They knowingly pretends to furnish a peace officer with information relating to an offense. I'm just a little troubled with the verbiage there. They knowingly pretend maybe to furnish a peace officer information relating to an offense. Would you... I mean, I don't think it's necessarily clear the way this is drafted. And then on the, even on line 15, reports to a peace officer an offense or other incident within the officer's concern. What does that mean, within the officer's concern?
Well, okay, so to your first question on line 17, pretends to furnish a peace officer with information relating to an offense or incident. In the example that I gave in my opening, the gentleman claimed to have been assaulted and he had a noose around his neck. And he claimed to have been had chemicals poured upon him. So he was pretending to... Just pretending. And, okay, and then line 15, reports to a peace officer an offense or other incident within the officer's concern, knowing that it did not occur. Well, here again, if you are giving a report that you have been abused or you've been offended and some criminally offended, assaulted in some way, that's obviously within the officer's area of concern. But if you have an idea for an improvement in the verbiage, I'm certainly open to that.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chairman, maybe I could refer that to Brian Thompson.
Mr. Thompson?
Maybe there's a good reason for that.
And, Senator, you are basically dealing with existing law here.
I know. I just... Well, it's a change. The change doesn't ring true to me. But
okay.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Esp, thanks for the question. I'll see if I can handle it. I think that the chairman very correctly pointed out that this bill is not changing the structure of already existing criminal code. This is really only about a change in the penalties on lines 22 through 25. However, I will address specifically your concerns in sub 1 sub B and sub 1 sub C. I think that sub B is really getting to the fact of, are you, with a lie, knowing that you're lying, causing a law enforcement response? And I think that that's what both of those sections are about. Does that help answer your question a little bit?
All right, thanks. I won't waste the committee's time anymore on it.
Okay, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe for Ellen Doan, please.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Doan, I was wondering if the Montana Department of Justice keeps statistics on false reporting of crimes by race from either the victim or the accuser?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that I heard the question.
She was wondering if the DOJ keeps race statistics on false reporting.
I don't know that answer, Mr. Chairman. I can get that back to you, the committee, if you'd like.
Okay. Senator, that good?
That's good. Thank you.
All right. Anyone else? Senator Sands.
Mr. Chairman, a question for, I think, Mr. Doan as well.
For who? Senator?
Department of Justice. Yes.
Representative Doan, come on up.
Mr. Chairman.
Thanks. Thank you. And a question sort of following up on Senator Weber, but do you keep statistics or have any information at all on the either number of reported where someone has claimed a false report or, in fact, any kind of case has been filed or successfully filed under the existing false reporting statute for a misdemeanor?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I have a terrible time hearing.
Could you get a little closer to your microphone?
Yeah. Here, I'll get a little closer. I'm asking for information on what is the history we have on the number of false accusations that have already been reported under the current misdemeanor statute. How many of those have actually been prosecuted, success rate, whatever you have? And also the number of cases you might currently have or have somewhere in the files of people that you, cases where you believe someone should have been charged with a felony, but in fact they were only charged with a misdemeanor or not charged at all. So what's the need for this? How is it currently, how much is it the current statute being used, and what numbers do you have to show that people are getting away with it who should have been charged with a felony in the state of Montana?
There were quite a few questions in there.
Mr. Chairman, I can go back and listen to the tape and get that information
if
we have it.
Does the department keep track of number of false reports and how many convictions on false reports?
I'll have to get that information. I don't know that off the top of my head.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Anyone else? Seeing none. Senator. Senator Friedel.
Sorry, I tried to sneak that one in on you, Chairman. This question would be for Ben Halverson.
Chairman, Senator.
Go ahead,
Friedel.
Senator.
Thank you. Mr. Halverson, how often, when it comes to partner family member assault charges, how often do those charges get dropped even after a supposed victim, changes their mind on that? Like, for instance, in your information you gave us, that you have three instances where they recanted their initial information to the officer. How often do you guys drop the charges after that?
in too into the details on this, I could report that it really depends on how thorough a recant it is, whether it's a line-by-line takedown of the original report, and whether we have corroborating evidence such as pictures or other witness statements, which rarely happens. And at the misdemeanor level, we are really limited in what we can do to pursue a case with an uncooperative victim. The felony level, there are ways to procure the testimony of a victim, whether she wants to offer that or not, and that is not an option available to us. But I would say of the three letters I submitted to this committee, each of them would be a complete deal breaker and would make that case unable to be prosecuted in the future.
Thank you.
Senator Sands?
Yes, thank you. A follow-up question for Mr. Halverson, please.
Okay. Mr. Halverson, could you get a little closer to your microphone, please?
Yes, sir. How's this working?
A little better.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Halverson. We all need to speak up for all of us. Question back to the issue of false accusations. So you prosecuted 1,200 cases last year simply in Billings alone, and I don't know what evidence you might have from elsewhere around the state, but how many of those 1,200 turned out to be a false accusation?
Well, Chair, Senator Sands, let me clarify. We received 1,200 cases last year. I am unable to prosecute even half those just because of the volume. I did not identify one single case involving a false police report last year. Looking back over my last 6 years in this job, I noticed approximately five cases that had something to do with an original charge of misdemeanor partner or family member assault that was later elevated in the one instance to evidence tampering, and others that were simply charged as misdemeanors.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
So is it your professional opinion as a prosecutor of these cases that the current evidence tampering and other statutes can address those needs?
In almost all circumstances, that is my professional opinion, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Senator Brown.
Yeah, since we didn't get out of here when we thought we could, but my question, I guess, is for the sponsor.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Manzella. So, as I read this, the only real thing that this is doing is adding a stiffer penalty for the false reporting of a felony. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir. Yes.
And then a follow-up.
Go ahead.
And in the as I read it, it still gives the judge complete latitude because be sentenced to not more than 4 years in the state prison or fine not more than $10,000. He could still say, depending on the case, that, hey, your fine's $50 and 10 hours of community service or something. Is that not correct as well?
Yes, sir. That is correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Senator, you may close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of Senate Judiciary. Thank you for the good hearing. I would like to address the bulk of the opponent's concerns, if I may, which is the sexual domestic violence. I'm here to tell you that you do not empower a woman by helping her to remain a victim in a sexual domestic violence situation. We as lawmakers have provided very stiff penalties for women who are raped, those being 20 years to life and $50,000. But we cannot do anything for that woman if she doesn't report it. We cannot seek justice on her behalf if she doesn't seek justice for herself. Conversely, women have been known to use the allegation of rape to their advantage, to destroy a man's life and a reputation. She should also be held accountable in those situations. Absolutely. But that's only a small part of the crimes that we're talking about. In our community, we had a false reported school bombing threat. And that was a very big deal for our little community and our resources. Our law enforcement was on the job night and day over that for some time. And there are decoy crimes now that are being committed where there might be a threat of a school bombing at one end of the valley while a crime is being staged and committed at the other end of the valley. Deliberately and intentional choreographed crimes. Insurance fraud is another one. So this is a lot, has a lot more breadth than just the issue of the sexual domestic violence. With the cries to defund the police, we absolutely need to be helping them in ways that we can. And they're reporting to me that they're quite frustrated with some of these situations when they know the reports should receive a felony penalty, but they're only getting the maximum they can get as a misdemeanor. So we need to be respectful of their time as well and their talents. And, you know, this is one of the Big Ten. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Pretty simple. Law enforcement's held to a higher standard. If they are caught falsifying information or lying on a report, it follows them through their career, and they can be assigned in a felony for that as well. So this just helps to level the playing field, and with that, I ask for a due pass.
This ends the hearing on Senate Bill 240. Next, we'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 242. Senator, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Bryce Bennett, and I have the honor of serving the people of Senate District 50, which includes Central and Southern Missoula. Before I begin, may I hand out an article?
Give it to the Secretary.
Members of the committee, today I bring you Senate Bill 242 to protect the privacy of one of the most personal pieces of data that is collected and sold, GPS data about where you've been and where you are at every moment, day and night. Today, our phone, computer, and other personal communication devices track your location through GPS technology at all points of the day. Not only when you open up the Maps app on your phone to get directions to the new restaurant in town, but 24 hours a day. Because of this, the companies know where you live, where you work, when and how often you go to the doctor, where you shop, where you worship, and of course, who you spend time with. In the story that is being passed around right now, I shared with you today, you can see that one woman's location was tracked over 8,600 times in a four-month period. This is a tremendous amount of information for anyone to have about a person. Even in close-knit families, it's unlikely you would know as much information about where someone is at every moment of the day and night. But companies have this data, and they are transferring and selling it to companies you've never heard of. This bill is an effort to educate Montanans on the fact that their location data is being gathered by companies and sold, and would secure their constitutional right to privacy by requiring them to opt in before the company can transfer or share this data. If you look at line 11, you'll see the entirety of what this bill does. It says, A person or entity may not sell or offer for sale location data that is recorded or collected from a customer's personal communication device without the explicit consent of the individual who is the primary user of the device. So if your phone company or an app wants to take the personal location data they have gathered from you and give it to someone else, they have to tell you and ask your permission first. It's important to note that I use the word explicit intentionally, burying this request for permission deep in the terms and conditions agreement in 5-point font will not be acceptable. The way I envision this happening is you'll have a pop-up open upon opening your new phone or a new app that tells you they plan on sharing your location data with other entities, groups, or companies. That's one initial notice at the beginning, not every time you use the app. They can explain why they want to share your location data and even what benefits you may get because of it. But ultimately, the decision on whether that data is able to be sold or transferred is in your hands as the consumer. Opponents will likely tell you that they can make the data anonymous and no one will ever realize which dot on the map is who. But if an anonymous dot stays at your address every night and then moves to your job during the day, it's incredibly easy for someone to figure out who that dot is with extremely limited knowledge of you. I've also had questions about how this bill might work in connection with bills that we've seen this session about getting information to law enforcement in emergencies or when they need to track down a criminal. This bill will not impede the normal warrant process to collect this data that already exists in law in any way. This bill is about asserting our individual constitutional right to privacy in a world where government and corporate intrusions in our life are becoming more and more prolific. I believe the data about where we are at every given moment of our lives should be guarded. We can and should give Montanans the ability to make their own decisions about what personal data is shared, not have that decision made for them. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I thank you for the opportunity to present Senate Bill 242 today. I look forward to a good hearing and would reserve the IH close.
Any proponents in the room?
Chair, members of the committee, Laurel Hess, H-E-S-S-E, here with ACLU of Montana to voice our support for Senate Bill 242. As the sponsor outlined, recent technological developments make it possible to obtain geolocational information with great precision in both real time and historically. Location and route data can reveal detailed, sensitive, and private information about consumers, which is why states like Oregon have passed similar bills. By requiring data collectors to obtain explicit consent from individuals before selling geolocational information, this bill would allow Montanans to preserve the privacy they have traditionally experienced, even as technology advances. For those reasons, we urge you to pass on Senate Bill 242. Thank you.
Any other proponents in the room? Proponents? Proponents online. Kim Mangold.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kim Mangold. That's M-A-N-G-O-L-D. And we rise in support of Senate Bill 242 on privacy legislation. Farmers and ranchers in Montana have always been very concerned about data that's collected on their farm operations. And we believe that data collected is the exclusive property of the operation and its management. Storage and use of data should be strictly prohibited without the well-defined legal consent of each individual. Thank you.
Okay. No other proponents in the room. We'll go to opponents. Any opponents in the room for Senate Bill 242?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Spencer. I'm an attorney here in Helena. Today I am representing the National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies. I'll be honest, you'd probably be better served by having your Zoom proponents go first, but I'll give it my best shot. I'm only going to talk to the concerns that insurance carriers have with the bill. I think your Zoom opponents are going to give you a much more rounded idea of what the bill is about. So insurance carriers use GPS data a lot when they use what's called telematics programs. And those are the programs you've probably heard about, which are put an app on your phone and agree to let us monitor your driving, or let us put a fob in your car. You agree to it. It's opt-in. It's not mandatory. They can't deny you insurance because of not agreeing to do the program, but they'll give you a discount so they can track your driving, and when they discover you have good driving, then you can get a further discount on renewal. And that system uses a lot of by necessity, it uses GPS data, and of course it's opt-in, and so all the provisions that you get online disclose what's going to happen. And not in five-point font at the end of the document. They know clearly that that information will be used. Well, not only is that information used, and identified information is used in that case to pick the correct rate for that driver, right? They have to know it's that driver, and they have to know where they're at. But de-identified information is also used and sent places. And insurance companies use this to get information on traffic areas that are dangerous so they can share that information. But one of the major reasons they used it, which was of great benefit to consumers during the pandemic, was they gathered the information on consumers' driving habits, they aggregated it, they studied it, and they realized, hey, during the pandemic and the lockdowns, people aren't driving. Well, insurance companies can't just say to a regulator, look, we want to give money back because people aren't driving anymore. You have to have some justification for it. Well, this allowed that justification. And if you all remember, a lot of auto insurance companies sent checks back to their consumers. Well, without that aggregated information, that anonymous information on driving, that might not have happened, because we wouldn't have had the justification to prove to the regulator that the giving the money back is important. So my clients have several concerns with the bill. It says location data. Does this include de-identified or aggregated data? We would hope not, because of some of the reasons I just told you. Explicit consent. Now, you heard the sponsor say, I envision that to be pushing a button. But as a lawyer, I'm going to tell you, if that comes before a court, I could certainly argue, oh, no, that's not enough explicit consent. You have to have a separate piece of writing. It has to be signed by the consumer. It's got to be retained by the company using the information. They have to be able to produce it at a moment's notice. And if you don't have that, you don't have explicit consent, and they violated the terms of the statute. It is not clear. That is just a term that has a lot of different meanings. So we would like to see that clarified for sure. Require that a consumer actively affirms reading and agreeing to the terms of the notice. It's on line 17 of the bill. Not sure what actively affirms mean. I mean, that could be many, many different things. And so, clarification of that would be a good thing. Finally, interesting concept. Does this bill apply to somebody who's vacationing in Montana and just driving through? They happen to be using a telematics agreement, happens to be on their phone or any other app on their phone, and they're just vacationing here in Montana? Or is this only applied to Montana residents? How is someone to know if they need to pop that up in Montana? I think that's a concern as well for compliance issues. For those reasons, and I understand that amendments wouldn't be looked on favorably, for those reasons we oppose the bill.
Any other opponents in the room? Opponents in the room? Seeing none. Online, and a lot of you online have submitted your written testimony. If you would, just highlight it for us. Let's start with Rose Feliciano.
Good morning, Chair Regier and members of the committee. My name is Rose Feliciano, F like Frank, E-L-I-C-I-A-N-O. I'm the Northwest Director of State Government Affairs for Internet Association. IA represents over 40 of the world's leading internet companies. IA members know that trust is fundamental to their relationship with consumers. Our members recognize that to be successful, they must meet consumers' reasonable expectations of how the personal information they provide to companies will be collected, used, and shared. Unfortunately, SB 242's approach to protecting location data will only lead to confusion because it lacks key definitions for businesses to comply with. The bill does not define location data, sale, collection, initial notice, or explicit consent. These terms are essential for businesses to adjust or refine their systems to protect consumers, and many of these terms could be legally interpreted in a variety of ways. Without further clarity of this terminology, it will be difficult, if not impossible, for businesses to comply with if enacted. In addition, IA is gravely concerned with the bill's immediate effective date. It is simply unrealistic to assume businesses or even individuals, as the bill states, would be able to comply with such a vague law at a moment's notice. Businesses need to have clear guidance and be given an appropriate amount of time to ensure their systems and procedures align with what is required in any law that is enacted. For those reasons, IA requests the committee not move SB 242 forward. Thank you.
Next, Carl Szabo.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Carl Szabo, C-A-R-L, S is in Sam, Z is in Zebra, A is in Apple, B is in Boy, O is in October. I am Vice President and General Counsel at NetChoice. I'm also an adjunct professor at the George Mason Antonin Scalia Law School. Now, you've heard a lot of the concerns, and we're getting close to lunchtime, so I'll try to be as quick as I can. You already have my testimony in front of you. So you've already heard how this legislation lacks key definitions. One of the key definitions that's also missing is, what is the definition of sale? So is a sale just making money on information, or is the sale a transfer of data? That is left unclear. One of the other concerns that you heard was on the issue of, does this apply to specific data or aggregated data? Now, the sponsor did make a good point about how if it's a bunch of dots and it shows a dot going from your home to the supermarket, you can eventually intuit that location. But if it is aggregated and de-identified, then it's incredibly useful. So when I'm traveling down the road, de-identified and aggregated data from a bunch of cars that have suddenly gone from 70 miles per hour down to 40 miles per hour can indicate perhaps an accident up ahead, or it can suggest a better route to take. Likewise, de-identified and aggregated data can help inform me as to the best times to go to the store. Is the local supermarket going to be busy at 8 a.m., or is it better to wait till 1 p.m.? A couple other things that are important to note is the issue on consent. One of the components is that essentially it requires a guardian being 18 years old to provide consent. Now, of course, one of the old adages is, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. So the ability for a platform to identify whether the user is over 18 or a minor is essentially impossible unless it collects a whole lot of other information to make that verification possible. And it sounds like the last thing the proponents want is more data collection to occur, but that's exactly what would be required under this legislation. Finally, it's important to note that this is essentially a solution in search of a problem. Today, every modern smartphone device, whether you're using an Android or Apple device, the basic operating system prohibits apps from accessing your location information without first giving express consent. Likewise, on every device, if you go into the settings location, you can, or settings part, you can find location data, what apps are being used, when it's being used, and toggle it both on and off easily. Finally, on both the Android and iOS mobile devices. There's an indication on every device you have when your location data is being collected. This legislation is not ready for prime time. It misses key definitions, and it's essentially a problem in search of a solution, and we would ask that you not advance this legislation.
Next, John McDonald.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, John McDonald. Last name is spelled M-A-C, capital D-O-N-A-L-D. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Alliance for Automotive Innovation. And just for background, the Alliance represents manufacturers that sell about 99% of the cars and light trucks that are sold in the U.S. today. And we also represent original equipment manufacturers and automotive technology providers. And we find ourselves in kind of an interesting position today because what this bill intends to do is something that the auto industry agrees with, fully supports, and in fact has adopted as a central principle to how our members operate. The auto industry believes very strongly that the data that is produced and stored and shared in a vehicle belongs to the owner of that vehicle, just like everything else in a car or truck, from the seatbelt to the spare tire to the floor mat. And specifically when it comes to the data, the industry has adopted a principle that it can be released only with affirmative consent of the owner. The concern that the industry has, Mr. Chairman and committee members, is that while this bill may not be intended to capture automobiles or automobile technology, we believe that it does. And our concern is attempting to meet and comply with what potentially could be 50 different state laws, all of which contain variations of the same theme and the same idea, but with different definitions, different standards, different language. When you're in the business of selling vehicles across the entire country, across 50 states, that can obviously be problematic. Mr. Chairman, that is our concern in a nutshell. I did want to point out all of you on the committee should have received two handouts from me in advance. The first is a letter from Josh Fisher with the Alliance that spells out the specific concerns with the language, again, largely based on definitions and some of the concerns that were already raised by previous speakers. So I won't go over that. And the second is a handout that gives just a quick overview of the Alliance and the auto industry's principles regarding vehicle data and an explanation of even why some of that data exists. And so just to conclude, Mr. Chairman, we do believe that protecting consumers' personal information is a priority. The auto innovators members have committed to doing that, to taking steps to protect the personal data that's generated by their vehicles. These privacy principles are enforceable through the Federal Trade Commission, and we believe they provide the heightened level of protection that this bill would seek to do. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll be available for any questions. Thank you.
Next, Lisa McCabe.
Hi, my name is Lisa McCabe, M-C-C-A-B-E, here on behalf of CTIA, the Trade Association for the Wireless Communications Industry, in opposition to Senate Bill 242. This bill is unnecessary and would add to further fragmentation of consumer privacy laws, and also raises particular concerns because it is technology and sector specific. CTIA members strongly believe that consumer information should be protected and that consumers should be given choices with respect to when and how their information is used. Under the Federal Trade Commission's privacy framework, all companies, including telecommunications carriers, receive affirmative opt-in consent prior to sharing mobile call location information. Consumer privacy protections should apply consistently across all industry sectors, and protections should be consistent for any given type of information. Senate Bill 242 applies to a specific type of information, location information that is collected on a customer's personal communications device. Because the requirements in this bill only apply to location data, the legislation favors certain business models and particular competitors over others. For instance, other internet-based companies have access to location data that's more granular than what a mobile provider might have, and they use that data for a variety of purposes. This bill is unfairly limited to the collection of one type of location data by one entity in the online ecosystem, something that consumers are unlikely to understand or expect. Privacy issues are better addressed with a holistic approach that doesn't favor one business model over another in order to lessen any unintended consequences and also provide consistent consumer protections. For these reasons, CTIA opposes Senate Bill 242 and requests that you not move further with the bill. Thank you.
Next, are there any informational witnesses in the room? Informational witnesses? Seeing none, questions from the committee? Senator Friedel.
Test? Oh, it was weird. Guess it's maybe a crapshoot who may be able to speak today. Chairman, this would be for the sponsor.
Mr. Chair, Senator Friedel.
Senator, question. I don't disagree with some of the opposition, and maybe we may need to clarify some terminology. But I'm reading right here. It says, line 11, a person or entity may not sell or offer the for sale of location data that is recorded, collected from a consumer's personal communication device without their explicit consent of individual who is the primary user of the device. It goes on about legal guardian. Now, as long as they get the consent of the user, they can sell this information, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Friedel, that's correct.
Okay, so, just follow up. So what you're telling me is that the only way that they can sell it, so if they say no to this, that they can't sell it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Friedel, that is correct.
Okay, follow up for...
Go ahead.
For Mr. Szabo, I hope I did not act that up. I apologize if I did.
Szabo?
Yes.
Mr. Szabo, Chairman, Mr. Szabo, question. Is this the type of data that gets used to geotrack where I'm at? So, for instance, if I happen to go to my job here today, it can literally tell you guys who I'm around, which means they know I'm here and they know I'm with all these legislators. And then does it allow someone like Facebook to then say, hey, by the way, you may know these people? Is that how this all works? Is that why I get those notifications, because it knows my location?
Mr. Chairman, to answer that question, the way that the algorithms make recommendations is actually based on a whole panoply of stuff, content. So more often than not, it's going to be based on who you're friends with and who they're friends with, and other interests that you may share in common. The collection of location for certain apps is going to be directly related to the service provided by that application at that time. An example, that would be a weather app or a maps app. Now, it may store that data so that you can reuse it. So, for example, I recently went to the supermarket, and it would store that data and that destination data so that next time I'm in the car around the same time, it might ask, hey, are you heading to the supermarket? And I would say yes. So the data is stored, but once again, one of the key components that I think is being overlooked is we already have tools to address uses of this data. It was alluded to earlier, but Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission's Act empowers not only the Federal Trade Commission, but your state AG, your state's attorney general, to take an enforcement action against any business operating in the state that violates not only its terms of service and privacy policies, things that are clearly defined, but any essential material violation of those policies. So even if it says in micro print, we're going to do something shady with your data, if that is an unfair use of that data, your state's attorney general can take an enforcement action today without ever needing this law against a business that is abusing your location data.
Thank you, sir.
Senator Sands.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for the sponsor. Mr. Chairman, Senator Bennett, a couple of questions. Some are just background, but there's no penalty section of this bill. What's the penalty for if this would pass for committing this offense?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sands, there's not a listed penalty in here. I think it would fall under the same levels of enforcement that the Attorney General or other law enforcement could pursue, depending on the situation, obviously.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Go ahead. So have there been cases where the Attorney General has pursued these cases in Montana?
Could you repeat that, Senator Sands?
Is there any history of the Attorney General's office prosecuting these cases in the state of Montana?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sands, you'd have to ask the Department of Justice for that. I don't remember hearing anything about that, but obviously this law is not on the books right now, so they don't have the capacity to, you know, push back on companies that may not comply with it.
And the final question, Mr. Chairman, for Senator Bennett, put this in some national context. I mean, given we've got this remote testimony option now, we hear from all these national people about the national situation. Could you kind of fill us in to where other states are dealing with this issue and what the national picture on this topic is?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sands, I think this is an evolving piece. I think that, as you've seen with these various privacy bills that I and others have brought over the years, Montana is often leading the way when it comes to privacy protections, and I think that's a good thing. The fact that we have a constitutional right to privacy, I think, is sort of our guiding light when it comes to pushing those bills forward. But I think that you heard from the folks at the ACLU that there are a few other states that have pushed forward bills like this. I know that there's a few that are in the works, but you know, I think this is an opportunity for Montana to be at the front edge of protecting this personal data.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator McGilvery.
For Bruce Spencer.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senator.
So, okay, we talked about car insurance companies collecting data that could create refund checks. I don't see the extension that you make from the company being able to collect that data if they, if for someone had an app on their phone or in their car. To me, that what you want to do is be able to sell that data. Am I correct? Because you don't need to, you don't need, this bill doesn't affect you collecting that data. This bill just prohibits you from selling that data. So why would you want to sell that data?
Because the not auto insurance companies don't do all the number crunching. They send that out to vendors to do those services for them, because that's not what auto insurance companies do. They do other things. So they do send aggregated data out to vendors to do services for them, and we're very concerned that this bill prevents that from occurring. And there's some payment for that.
So follow up?
Be upfront about it.
Go ahead.
So are you actually selling that data to these vendors?
Right. There is payment for the data. The vendors do pay for the aggregated data.
And then why do they want the data?
So they can provide the services back to different entities by using that data. And some of those services are very beneficial to auto insurance companies.
But ultimately, I would have to say that there's profit for these insurance companies to sell this data. Am I not correct?
That it's, I'm sorry, it's a problem?
No, profit.
I suppose a minor income. This isn't their business or business model. I don't really have any figures or knowledge of how much dollar amount the transactions are, so I'm not really able to answer that.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Senator, you may close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for a great hearing. I do just want to touch on a couple things. I think that what you heard from the opponents of this bill is they're saying that it is confusing. I don't find this to be a terribly confusing concept. This is just saying, if you want to be able to share that location data, you have to ask me first. I don't know that that's that much to ask. And there's a few definitions that they were asking about, which I also think are fairly straightforward. You know, things like, what is location data? I think it's data about where you are at any given time. I mean, what is a sale? I think that we're all pretty aware of what a sale is. You know, collection seems pretty straightforward to me as well. I don't mean to be flip about this, and I'm happy to provide, you know, an amendment that would further define these things, but I think that there is a level of common sense that seems pretty clear throughout this bill as well. I believe that we own our data and should have the decision on what is done with this. If people want to share that information, I think that's a personal choice that they can make. And I think that you heard from a number of the opponents out there saying that right now, some of them are already doing it this way. Some of them have a similar service. I mean, when you heard about the good driver information, people are already opting into it. And that's exactly what we're trying to do here. If folks want to be able to sell this information, they should have to ask. And that's another important thing that I do want to clarify, is that this is not saying that you have to get the permission to use the location data services. I know that on my phone, there's a number of different apps that I use, the Maps app and other different things out there, where I say, you can use my location right now to get me where I want to go or to give me information about the weather in the town that I happen to be in at that moment. This bill is about what you do with that location data that you've collected, whether you are allowed to transfer it to someone else, to sell it to someone else without my permission. That, I think, is the big difference, because this location data is a big deal. And I think that sometimes we kind of skirt away from what exactly we're talking about. I mean, the thing that's in your pocket or the laptop that you have on your desk is able to tell people where you are, who you are with, where you're going at every single moment of the day. And certainly there are benefits to that. But there's also some problems. And I think ultimately I want the consumers in Montana to be able to say, I either give you permission or I don't. And I think that that's exactly what this bill is about. So I would urge you to pass, and thank you again for a good hearing.
This ends the hearing on Senate Bill 242.
Members of the committee will begin the hearing on Senate Bill 194. Senator Regeer, would you open on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Keith Regeer, that's R-E-G-I-E-R, Senator from Senate District 3. Senate Bill 194 revises misdemeanor probation officer laws so that an officer not publicly employed may order the arrest of an offender. That is accomplished on page 1, line 22, by striking the words publicly employed. There are private businesses in Montana that contract for misdemeanor probation services. Missoula Correctional Services and Alternatives in Billings are private community correctional providers. Their service helps keep public services from being overcommitted. The private probation officers go through the same post-training that public officers do. The private services pay for the training of their employees, so there's no cost to the state. From 1996 to 2012, Missoula Correctional Services employees had the same arrest authority as public officers. A decision by the Law Enforcement Academy to only allow public employees to be post-trained stopped private arrest authority. Statute approved in the 2019 session of the legislature allowed private employees to receive post-training again. Senate Bill 194 will restore the arrest authority that they used to have. It's important that these private providers have arresting authority. When offenders are placed under probation supervision by the court, they violate their court order supervision, it is a matter of public safety that they be detained. An example would be a DUI offender who is found intoxicated. Well, this is not a violation of the law, but it is a violation of a condition of probation. The offender has demonstrated through past behavior that they will drive when drinking, presently posts then a public safety risk and needs to be detained. Members of the committee, you were given a handout that was titled Non-Government Employee Rest Authority. These are seven examples in code where non-government employees have arresting authority. I think you'll find that interesting going over that. And note that those arrest authorities don't require any training. with the same training as public employees, there will not be any inconsistencies in ordering arrest of an offender with Senate Bill 194. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Any proponents in the room for Senate Bill 194? Okay, we're going to go out. Mr. Metropoulos, go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Vice Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Metropoulos. That's spelled M-E-T-R-O-P-O-U-L-O-S. I'm a lawyer and lobbyist in Helena, and I represent Missoula Correctional Services. I want to give a little bit of background on this bill. As those of you who are not freshmen here, there's only one, I think, are well aware of, there are odd dynamics can occur during the course of a legislative session. All sorts of things can occur, which makes it interesting and fun sometimes. But in the course of that, in 2019, the words that Senate Bill 194 restores to the statute were deleted. The deletion of those words left a two-year gap in the arrest authority of private misdemeanor probation officers. They had had that authority under statute since 1995 when the first such statute was enacted, 4623-1005. But in the course of 2019, they were deleted. So all this bill does is restore those words and restore historic arrest authority that those individuals have used. Now, we're going to have some people on Zoom testifying in support of this bill. Dan Cederberg, who is the longtime lawyer for Missoula Correctional Services, and one of Missoula Correctional Services officers, Maria, whose last name I can't remember, but the committee secretary just passed out her written testimony to you. They can explain two things in particular. One is Maria will speak to the instances when it's important for them to have this arrest authority. Those officers aren't typically out in the community looking for someone to violate their parole, but when they come into their office, and for example, if a probationer comes in and he's high or drunk, and that's a violation of his probation, if they can't arrest that person right then, they have to let him go, which presents a danger to the public safety. And it's, frankly, I think, kind of an absurd one. Dan can speak to, I think there may be some concern about potential liability for local governments if private individuals have this authority. I just point out that liability hasn't been a problem for almost 30 years, and it isn't a problem. Under the contracts that local governments enter with private entities, there's indemnity clauses, and the responsibility remains with the private entity up until turning over the offender to the public people. So the fact is, in Montana for almost 30 years, private entities have been key parts in the justice system in keeping the public safety in at least the Missoula and Billings communities. We'd like to have this authority restored so we can do that job fully and well as we have for decades. Thank you very much. Appreciate a due pass on this bill.
Thank you. Any further proponents in the room?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Alan Doan, D-O-A-N-E, here today from the Montana Department of Justice. We support this bill. We think it's a public safety issue. Thank you.
Further proponents? Okay, we're going to go online then. Amanda Green for proponents.
Good morning, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Green, spelled G-R-E-E-N. I am here in support of Senate Bill 194. I'm currently the Director of Development for Alternatives in Billings, and for 5.5 years previously managed the Beta Jail Alternatives and Misdemeanor Probation Program. Alternatives has been contracting with Yellowstone County to provide alternatives to incarceration since 1984 and currently operates in four counties, including Yellowstone, Stillwater, Carbon, and Sweetgrass. Additional services can also be provided to Muscle Shell, Bighorn Park, and other counties upon request. Misdemeanor probation has been a local service since 1997, when retired Justice of the Peace Larry Herman requested the program be developed specifically for his court. And then in 2002, the City of Billings followed suit to contract with us. Furthermore, the Montana Department of Corrections Interstate Compact Division utilizes alternatives to supervise the out-of-state misdemeanor offenders who live in and around the Billings area. Alternatives provides ongoing training and implementation of probation and pretrial services, and all officers attend the Montana Law Enforcement Academy Public Safety Officer Standards Training specific to misdemeanor probation and pretrial supervision officers, which includes topics such as discretionary use of arrest powers. The current supervisor of this program has been certified as a state felony probation officer in both Wyoming and Oklahoma and has attended this Montana post training. She comes with a depth of experience and training. Other officers at our agency have attended post as sheriff's officers. And in total, our four officers have almost 30 years of correctional experience. As part of the programs and services offered, Alternatives is expected to meet with clients one-on-one, which generally occurs up to daily, depending on the severity of the crime and the compliance of the offender. 17 staff track compliance and report noncompliance to the referring court. However, probation is more than just supervision. These one-on-ones include job development, discussion of addiction, and partner family member assault treatment, program compliance and connection with community programs and services such as housing, medical, and mental health care, as well as developing a pro-social support system. All items that are scientifically proven to reduce recidivism and increase public safety. We ensure that our clients are back to work being productive members of society. And while nearly 78% of our jail alternative offenders at Alternatives successfully complete their mandated programming, there are times that officers must implement training and coordinate with judges and prosecutors for issues of noncompliance. Alternatives probation and pretrial officers complete mandatory and yearly training related to de-escalation, compliance enforcement, and defensive tactics. Drug and alcohol testing are performed, and staff work closely with victim witness coordinators. Despite all these efforts, there are times when officers must take additional steps to mitigate damage and prevent an offender from harming themselves or others when intoxicated or under the influence of drugs, or when violating no contact conditions as part of partner family member assault cases. Alternatives takes measures to ensure the utmost safety of the community, staff, and the offenders we serve, using the least restrictive means necessary. While not ideal, this legislation permits officers from performing necessary tasks associated with their job description, which includes arrest in critical conditions. I sincerely request that you pass this legislation in order to affirm the work of the companies like mine and enable us to continue to provide the sound quality services to Yellowstone and continuing counties, something that we have done for nearly 35 years. I will stand by for questioning as necessary.
Thank you. Sue Wilkins. I think you're muted, Ms. Wilkins.
Yes, can you hear me,
yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, we can hear you.
Great. Thank you, co-chair and members of the committee. And thank you, Senator Regeer, for doing such a great job presenting your information on the bill. My name is Sue Wilkins, spelled W-I-L-K-I-N-S. I'm the executor of Missoula Correctional Services. We're a nonprofit corporation that contracts with both the city of Missoula, the Missoula County, and the state of Montana to provide various community correction programs in our community. We've been doing such since 1994, and MCS, which is our abbreviated name, started the first misdemeanor probation in the state of Montana in 1996. We did that through funding that was received through grants with the Board of Crime Control at that time, along with funding from Missoula County. Missoula County had requested that we start such a program, and it's been, I think, quite successful. We also assisted other jurisdictions in the state to start their own programs. Some of those were government programs, and some of those were nonprofits, such as Alternatives. I am before you as a supporter of Senate Bill 194, which, as you've heard, restores arrest authority to misdemeanor probation officers who are properly trained and who work for non-public private partners in the justice system. I've been working in community corrections for 40 years and believe that arrest authority is vital for community safety measures. There tends to be a misconception that misdemeanor crimes are minor, you know, more minor than felony crimes. And, you know, that's true in some cases, such as traffic offenses. However, there are a number of crimes that fall into violent categories that are misdemeanor offenses, and these are the ones that our programs primarily are supervising. Things like domestic abuse, multiple DUIs, stalking, criminal endangerment, assault cases. Those are all cases that can be in misdemeanors. We also supervise individuals who were originally arrested on a felony, and then through the plea bargaining system came down and had their crime reduced to a misdemeanor and were placed under our supervision. So I do want to emphasize that we supervise a number of different types of offenders. I think, as you know, the ability to arrest probation cases who violate court-ordered conditions, supervision conditions, increases local accountability for those under supervision and also for public safety. MCS believes that placing someone in Missoula's detention center anytime should only occur as a last resort and when there's a concern for public safety and or a potential safety of the offender that needs to be addressed. I think MCS's history does speak for itself in that we operated safely for many years with arrest authority, and I understand the importance of public safety. We also understand that our arresting someone is not something that should ever be taken lightly. And we have never been accused of abusing that authority when we had it, and we would not want to have that happen in the future. I ask that you please support the passing of this legislation in order that we can ensure accountability for offender actions and that public safety may be more adequately addressed by our officers supervising these offenders. Again, thank you for your time. I'll remain available if you have any questions. I appreciate you listening.
Thank you. I see the next two proponents are also from Missoula Correctional Services, so if you'll be kind enough to keep your comments short and not repeat what has always already been said by the previous Missoula Correctional Services individual. Thank you. Go ahead, Maria.
Good morning, Mr. Vice Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Maria McLean. McLean spelled M-C-L-E-A-N. I would just like to say, in support of Senate Bill 194, which does restore arrest authority to misdemeanor probation officers who are properly trained and who work for non-public agencies in the criminal justice system in Montana. I have over 17 years experience working with Missoula Correctional Services. I have been in a supervisory capacity for over 10 years. I'm presently the chief of the pretrial supervision program. For over 3 weeks in November of 2019, I attended the Montana Law Enforcement Academy with 15 other misdemeanor and pretrial officers from across the state of Montana, coming from governmental agencies and private nonprofit agencies alike. Montana Post Council certified my training for having fulfilled the requirements of education, training, and experience as prescribed by the administrative rules of Montana. I would like to speak regarding a domestic violence situation. We supervised an individual on probation for domestic violence, a partner family member assault. While on call, I received a phone call from law enforcement that they had responded to the home of this offender because he had broken the door, his bedroom door, off of its hinges. And law enforcement responded to this home, and they could not arrest him because it's not a crime to damage your own property. While there, they determined that he was high and his behavior was violent in nature. He had cut off his GPS anklet. As I said, he was on for partner family member assault. So they couldn't arrest him for the crime of damaging his bedroom door, nor could they arrest him for having cut off his GPS anklet. And that event put his victim in grave danger, because having removed his GPS anklet, we could no longer track his location in the community, putting his victim in grave danger and substantial risk. However, if these violations occurred in Bozeman, Ravalli, or Rosebud counties, this individual would have been arrested for a probation violation arrest. However, in Missoula or Billings, this offender would have remained at liberty until he could hurt someone. If Senate Bill 194 is enacted, we can address this situation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Dan Cederberg. Dan, go ahead.
Can you hear me, Mr. Vice Chairman?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dan Cederberg. Last name is spelled C-E-D-E-R-B-E-R-G. I'm an attorney in Montana, have been for over 40 years, and I've represented Missoula Correctional Services for approximately 20 years. I want to speak to the liability issue here that we anticipate is going to be used or raised by the opponents to the legislation and discuss that matter. Our contracts with both the city and county of Missoula set up a situation where the correctional services is an independent contractor. The language is very clear in the contracts that indicates that's the case. As such, the city or county governmental authorities are not responsible for the conduct of Missoula Correctional Services in acting in its capacity as an independent contractor. For example, if we arrest someone, if an officer of Missoula Correctional Services arrests someone and brings them to the detention facility in Missoula, the detention facility and the county are not responsible for the conduct of the Missoula correctional officer prior to the time the offender is delivered to the detention facility. The employee of Missoula Correctional Services is operating as an independent contractor during that time, and the county has no liability for those actions under the independent contractor law. So the only time at which the county or the city would incur any responsibility liability-wise was after they actually became actively involved in the situation. In the detention facility example, when the offender was delivered to the detention facility, at that time, employees of Missoula County who were under the supervision of Missoula County would then have some liability, but not before then. Additionally, the contract between the city and the county and Missoula Correctional Services includes an indemnity clause. That clause indicates that in the event there were a claim made by someone against the county based on conduct engaged in by Missoula Correctional Services employees, Missoula Correctional would have to indemnify the city or the county for that claim. This indemnity claim is also backed up by an insurance requirement in the contract. Missoula Correctional Services has to maintain insurance pursuant to the terms of the contract so that if there is a claim made and the indemnity provision of the contract is invoked by the city or county, there is insurance to back up that indemnity situation. Based on that and the public safety issues that were articulated by the other proponents, I would strongly urge the committee to move favorably on Senate Bill 194, and I am available for questions.
Thank you. Any further proponents in the room or online? Okay, seeing none, we will go to opponents of Senate Bill 194.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Brian Thompson, T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N. I'm here today on behalf of the Montana Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association. And the Montana Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association has several concerns with this bill and the way it's currently drafted. Number one, that being that in my reading of this bill and of the associated statutory language and definitions, I don't think this bill grants arrest authority to a misdemeanor probation officer. Now, if you will permit me, I'll point you to 46-23-1001. That's the definition section for the code that this bill is altering. And there are two separate definitions there that I'm looking at. I'm looking at sub 5 and sub 8. Sub 5 defines a misdemeanor probation officer, and sub 8 defines a probation and parole officer. Those are two separate things, A and B. Now, if you go to the statute that provides for the arrest authority, that statute is also not in the bill. That is in 46-23-1012. What this section provides in sub 2 is any probation and parole officer may arrest the probationer. Now, as we just discussed, in 1001, that does not include a misdemeanor probation officer. And if you look at the language in the bill now, and that's on section 1005, sub 3, line 22, a misdemeanor probation officer may order the arrest. That doesn't say may arrest, it says they may order the arrest. And if you look at the handout that the proponents had handed out, they go through a list of other private persons that do have arrest authority, and if you go and look at every single one of those statutes that's cited in there, that would be for bail and surety, railroad conductors, so on and so forth. If you go look at those statutes, it either says this person may arrest or has the authority of a peace officer to arrest. So I don't think that this bill quite does what the proponents want to, and maybe that should be clarified and fixed a little bit. The next part of our concern is with the bill as it's currently drafted. It says that the misdemeanor probation officer may order the arrest, as we discussed. As drafted, we interpret that to mean they can order the arrest from a peace officer or somebody else with arrest authority. And I guess we would like some clarifying language to say what happens if they order the arrest and the jail is full. Or what happens when they order the arrest and the law enforcement officer, the peace officer, wants to exercise a little bit of discretion. Now, I talked to Sheriff Linder yesterday about this bill, and he says most of the time in Billings, they're not even taking in their own small nonviolent misdemeanors because they don't have room at the jail, much less for some probation violations. I think there needs to be a little bit of clarification in this bill to allow for some law enforcement peace officer discretion. As far as the liability concerns, I don't think we actually have that many. These agreements are well set up. From what I've heard, there is a little bit of concern more from a public policy question. And that public policy question that I think that this body should be aware of is, who do we want to have arrest authority over our citizens? How do we want to make sure that our citizens' Fourth Amendment search and seizure rights are protected? And right now, that's with sworn peace officers generally. And I think it's just a question that this committee should think about as they continue to move on this bill. That's the extent of my comments. I'll be here if you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there opponents in the room?
Chairman, members of the committee, Sam Forstag, F-O-R-S-T-A-G, here on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union of Montana. We rise in opposition to this bill, and I'll be brief because there's little I can add to the testimony of the previous opponent. I'll simply say as the question here that I hope you are all considering is whether or not it's in the public interest to be further outsourcing the enforcement of justice. The authority to arrest a private citizen here in Montana is one of the gravest and most immense authorities that we as a state with power vested from our citizens vest in our peace officers. And when we have a series of private companies who are asking for an expansion of their authority to deprive a citizen of their rights to life and liberty, that raises serious concerns in enforcement for their rights under the Fourth Amendment, under the Fifth Amendment, under the 14th Amendment, and serious concerns, I hope, to all of you as a matter of what is good public policy and what sort of authority we want to grant private companies over Montana citizens. So we urge a no on this bill, and I do appreciate your time.
Thank you. Are there opponents in the room? See none. Are there any online?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right. Questions from the committee or informational witnesses? Okay, see none. Questions from the committee. Senator S.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question from Mr. Thompson. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Thompson, could you just supply those cites that you made to the committee in an email form or something?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Aspen. Thank you.
Further questions? Oh, I see. Senator Weber, sorry. My colorblindness in that yellow on that screen does not help me. So go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Question for Mr. Doan, please.
I don't think Alan Doan's in the room.
Oh. Okay. Well, I guess I don't have anyone else to ask. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Brown?
Let's go with the sponsor, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, Senator.
I guess if you feel free to defer this if you wish, but you know, first off, yeah, I mean, are you willing to work with the Mr. Thompson on some clarification on some of that language that they needed?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, depends upon what it is. A lot of what he was referring to is existing law now. Example, may order the arrest. I mean, that's been going on. I really feel it's opposition just trying to divert what the bill is doing here. But, yeah, I'll work with him.
Okay. And then, you know, in your follow-up, excuse me, Mr. Chair, you know, I'm seeing this is not only you know public safety. I think that's certainly is a real issue, but also you know for these parolees, if you find one that's kind of going off the rails a little bit, and you're able to interrupt that situation a little sooner. I mean, don't you see that as a benefit to not only the public but to that person as well?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think you're right on there that if they know that if they show up violating their parole and are going to get arrested, it's for their benefit, too. They'd probably be keeping themselves cleaner longer.
Thank you.
Senator Sands.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Question for Mr. Thompson, please. Mr. Vice Chair, Mr. Thompson, thank you for your comments. You know, those of us who sort of hang around the edges, at least, of understanding the issues around criminal justice world are well aware of the fact that we have jail overcrowding that is really unacceptable for lots of reasons. And so currently, as you stated, in many locations, we are not putting people in jail for a misdemeanor. Can you talk to me about what the winnowing process is and under what authority? If someone is arrested, is the only choice to put them in jail? What are the options that are available for someone who has violated or committed a misdemeanor or allegedly committed a misdemeanor around jail holds? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sands, and I apologize, it was tough to hear you. I think I got it all. The question was, what are the other options besides just jailing somebody? And I think that that really depends just on the locality. The other options are to simply cite the person for a new crime and tell them to show up either in justice court. Right now, I do know that most of the jails that are significantly impacted and are really struggling with space, they're really only taking violent crimes, PFMA, those kind of violations, or significant felonies.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman. When you say citing someone, is that the same as arresting someone? And so does someone who has violated their probation, say in this case, what are the options? What does citing mean?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sands, so citing somebody is part of a search and seizure, I believe. A person can come under arrest, and that's a search and seizure, and then later be released and cited with an information and told to show up at justice court. It's the charging of a crime, essentially. Generally, there are other options available once they're booked and processed. They can just simply be released on their own recognizance. In some cases, there are some supervised release programs, and then, of course, bail and bond.
Okay, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Mr. Vice Chair. I had a question for Mr. Doan, but I will ask Mr. Cederberg. Is he still here?
Yes, he's online.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Vice Chair, Mr. Cederberg, I just have a question. I was just looking up the MCA citations here through this bill, and one of them was 46-23-10-11, which is supervision of probation, and then 46-23-1003, and that's the qualifications of the probation and parole officers. And you're from a private company? Is that how I understand it?
Mr. Vice Chairman, Senator Weber, yes, that's correct.
Okay, so does the DOJ or who tracks your the private qualifications of the probation officers? Do you self-report, or how does that work?
Mr. Vice Chairman, Senator Weber, that is tracked by POST. Our officers are trained by POST. They're certified by POST, just the same as the governmental officers are. And if there are problems with our officers, they are subject to the disciplinary process that is in place for the governmental officers through POST.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Senator.
Okay, so in 1003, it says that the qualifications of probation and parole officers have to have a college degree and formal training in behavioral science. Those are some really high benchmarks. Does that apply to your company? I mean, is that one of the qualifications for employment in your company besides POST?
Mr. Vice Chairman, Senator Urbert, yes, we are subject to all those statutory provisions. There are also some annual educational requirements in the statute. We are subject to those, and we provide those, and we try to go beyond those in our training.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Senator. Any other questions? Senator Fardell.
Thank you, Chairman. This would be for Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Friedel.
Good morning. Sorry, I didn't mean to get your leg days in today. Sorry. Question. We're talking about probation misdemeanor. We're not talking about parole or parolees. These people have not been through the system as a person that's been sentenced to jail. These are typically people that are probation that at most would see a year in jail possibly. Can you tell me what the typical person that's being put on probation, what are their charges usually?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Friedel, I'm sorry. I'm not prepared to give a good answer on that one. I can...
But you would, could you maybe elaborate to the fact that most of these are reason why they're on probation is because it's, they're being not as they don't want to put them in jail for the offense. They want to put them on probation because the offense really wasn't to the warrant to a jailable offense. Would you,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Friedel? I think you're right on. I mean, it's within the structure of the justice system of this state and within the sentencing authority of various district court judges and justices of the peace.
Follow-up question, Chairman.
Go ahead.
And typically when there's a situation where a probation officer feels that their defendant, what would you, I guess we would have to define client. Let's just go there because since we're talking about private side of things, typically what's being done, would it be correct to assess that if there's a violation or even a technical violation of the court sentencing that on this situation, most of the times, if there's a misdemeanor probation officer, they'd put an NTA out or notice to appear to show up in front of a court?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Friedel, that is common, yes. Notice to appear in front of a court, yeah.
And follow-up question?
One more.
And in a situation where someone needs to be arrested, would it be the best interest to have that particular probation officer, misdemeanor probation officer, to call law enforcement and allow them as the governmental agency to arrest this person so that make sure that they don't impact someone's Fifth Amendment rights and Fourth Amendment rights?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Friedel, I think that that's part of my last question that I really asked in my testimony is for this body to consider whether or not that is the best public policy. Yes, I would agree with you that that would be an appropriate method of conducting misdemeanor probation, yes.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, we'll have the sponsor close.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. You know, these private officers are not going to be out chasing speeders down the highway or chasing bank robbers. Their arrest authority will provide public safety by detaining offenders that are violating their court-ordered probation. So Senate Bill 194 is good policy for Montana, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. We'll go ahead and open the hearing on SJ number 8. Senator Regier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Keith Regier, that's R-E-G-I-E-R, Senator from Senate District 3. Senate Joint Resolution 8 is a resolution to ask the United States Congress to propose an amendment to the United States Constitution that requires the United States Supreme Court to be composed of 9 justices. And if you look at the bill, the whereases, they're short and to the point. Starting on line 9, an independent United States Supreme Court is an essential element of America's system of checks and balances that protects our constitutional rights. The United States Supreme Court has been composed of 9 justices for more than 150 years, and the President of the United States and the United States Congress should be prohibited from undermining the independence of the United States Supreme Court by changing the number of justices on the United States Supreme Court. Committee, there are various entities of government that have a set number of participants. The U.S. House has 435 members. It's been that way since 1911. The U.S. Senate has 2 senators from each state. The Montana House has 100 members and the Senate 50. These membership numbers seem to work the best and shouldn't be altered without much deliberation. In the last year, there has been talk about increasing the number of U.S. Supreme Court justices. Some people call it court packing. The Supreme Court has been 9 members since 1869. To increase the number would be motivated by partisan efforts and jeopardize the checks and balances that the court is to provide. It has been said that a resolution is just a wish list, and though it does not carry the effect of law, it does send a message to the U.S. Congress and all of our fellow states that Montana wants a 9-member Supreme Court. It will encourage other states to join in the dialogue. Just like lobbyists and constituents asking for your vote on an issue, this resolution can prompt Congress to enact a Keep 9 amendment to the Constitution. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Any proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Vice Chairman. For the record, my name's Alan Olson, and I am here on my own behalf this morning. Mr. Chairman, you go back years and years ago when Franklin Roosevelt was president. Franklin Roosevelt had issues that he couldn't get some of his agenda run through the process, and there was an attempt to add Supreme Court justices at that time, and the Congress refused. There's not a lot that I can add to Senator Regeer's opening on this, but the court needs to be depoliticized. I, too, have heard a lot of the discussion this last election cycle, post-election, that we need more members on the Supreme Court. Every president has the opportunity to make those appointments. Every president has taken the opportunity to make those appointments upon advice and consent of the Senate. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, members of the committee, there is no need to increase the size of the Supreme Court. This proposed amendment can set the tone. It can send the signal through this resolution to our congressional delegation, as well as delegations from other states, that we see no reason to increase the size of the Supreme Court from 9 members. And I think it's about time that we did have a constitutional amendment to keep the size of the court at 9. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Any other proponents online or in the room? Seeing none, we'll go to opponents. Don't see any. Questions from the committee? No informational witnesses. Questions from the committee?
Thank you, Chairman. This is for the sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, Senator.
Thank you. Good morning. You definitely read the Amendment 9. It has no language in there telling you who you can limit, how many you can limit. In fact, my argument would be to have 51. Each state have their own Supreme Court justice on the federal, to be perfectly honest with you. pardon me. I just think it's interesting. The question is, do you think that even though I agree with you, I think the limited amount as possible is the appropriate manner, but do you think we have steps in place to halter that? Even though the president may ask for a 10th, 11th, 12th, and in my case, 51 Supreme Court justices, isn't it up to the Senate to either say yes or no to that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'm not sure what the exact process to changing the number on the court would be. I just want it to stay 9.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, sponsor wants to close.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, 9 Supreme Court justices worked well for a long time. Let's leave it that way. Thank you.
Thank you. This closes the hearing on SJ number 8.
That's a great one.
I'm sure. I'm sure.
We'll do executive action starting with Senate Bill 219 and then 223, and I'll give you, is 5 minutes enough time to get things together? Senator Sands? Okay, well, let's go to 11:30. We'll give you a little more time. We'll be back at 11:30. We're in recess. committee. Let's be in order, please. Start with Senate Bill 219. Is anyone still working on amendments on 219? Okay, this was a bill by Senator Howard, an act providing for the release of call location information to law enforcement. Mr. Vice Chair?
Mr. Chair, I would move to pass on Senate Bill 219.
Okay. We do have an amendment, but Ms. Burkhart, I have copies of two different amendments, and they both have the same number.
Mr. Chairman, it would be the amendment. These amendments got a little messed up in our system. The correct amendment for 219 is the one offered by Senator Howard. It'll say David Howard at the top. And on the right, it says SB 219 1.2. And then the newer amendment also makes several other changes by substituting or taking out the word call and making it say phone location throughout the bill. That's the actual change that Senator Howard requested.
Okay, and does that amendment have six paragraphs?
Yes.
Okay. The other amendment we just disregard?
Yes, please.
Yeah, there isn't a 1.2 on this one, though. Okay, on the gray.
Oh, okay.
The gray sheet. Okay, so should we refer it to as 1.2?
Yes, please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right,
Mr. Chair, I'd move to pass on Senate Bill 219, the amendment 0.1.2.
Okay, and committee members, it's one that has six paragraphs. And they're striking call and placing phone in it. Anyone not have that amendment? Okay. Ms. Burkhart, you want to fill us in on why the Senator Howard has this?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. What Senator Howard was trying to do was initially this amendment only took out call and substituted phone in Section 2, which is on page 2, line 13. That's the original amendment that you had. And then after that, I did some work on it, and I got a hold of him and had a chat with him and said, do you want to change it all the way through the document? Because it'll make it a lot more sense. But obviously, it's up to him, and he agreed that that was the way to go. And so... And so I made that change for him. So rather than referring to call location, this would refer to phone location. So I think the direction that Senator Howard was going, and you'd have to confirm with him, was to be clear that the data that's being given away, or provided rather is the right term, is only refers to where the phone is and not necessarily anything that's on the phone.
And,
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and it seems that phone location would fit better with the intent of his bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's also what Senator Howard said.
Okay, questions or comments on the amendment? Senator Bennett.
Mr. Chair, members of the body, I'm happy to support this, but I feel like this bill would be better served by having an or instead of striking call, because they do, as I mentioned in the bill that I just presented, have the ability not to just know where your phone is at that moment, but where you made a call previously. And I think that in an emergency situation where we're trying to find somebody, being able to see where they were before, as opposed to, in addition to like where they are now, obviously with the warrant, I think is helpful. So I don't think there's any harm in adding this to this, but I think that we might want to think about a floor amendment or something in the future that could be a both sort of situation.
I was going to suggest that you talk to Senator Howard and a floor amendment. I mean, that would make sense to me too. Okay. Anyone else on the amendment? On the amendment? Okay. Can we try a voice vote on amendment 219.1.2? All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Got a
Senator proxy. Gross votes aye by proxy.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move Senate Bill 219 as amended once.
Okay. Senate Bill 219 amended once. Any questions, comments on the bill? Senator Bennett.
Mr. Chair, I just do want to add quickly that last time I mentioned I was looking for some information from Mr. Thompson, who was very, very kind to have a good long conversation with me about this. The thing I appreciate about this bill is that it speeds up the work that the phone company has to do. It doesn't in any way inhibit the warrant process that makes sure that people's private data is being protected except for these emergency situations. So I think it's good at protecting that privacy and getting law enforcement the information when they need it.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay. The motion is do pass Senate Bill 219 as amended once. Let's try a voice vote. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
Senator Gross votes aye by proxy.
Okay. Passed unanimously. Next, we have Senate Bill 223 by Senator Gauthier. That was an act revising firearms laws, the firearms qualification for retired officers. Anyone working on amendment on that bill? Okay. Mr. Vice Chair.
I'd move to pass on Senate Bill 223.
Okay. Questions, comments? Senate Bill 223. Senator Manzella.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the bill. I had to leave a few minutes early, so I did notice. I wanted to ask the question as to a fiscal note associated with this. There's no fiscal note, and I'm thinking maybe there should be. And then also conspicuously missing was law enforcement and DOC to come in and offer their opinion on the bill. And so I don't know if that happened to be talked about after I left yesterday. But I did talk to my sheriff last night about the bill, and he really likes it. So regardless of my other two concerns, my earlier concerns, I am going to support the bill.
Ms. Burkhart, regarding a fiscal note, I think there was
Mr. Chairman, there is a fiscal note to the bill. However, it is it's zero.
Yep.
Net impact general fund balance, zero over the next 4 years.
We found it and got Senator Manzella a copy.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anyone else on Senate Bill 223? Okay. Let's try a voice vote. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Senator Gross votes aye by proxy.
Okay. Passed unanimously. Committee, we're bumping up against transmittal. Next week will be a little bit busier. We will not meet Monday morning, but we will meet 8 o'clock Tuesday morning for executive action, and at 9 o'clock hear bills after that, and then plan on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of next week starting at 8 o'clock with bill hearings. Okay? So Monday, no judiciary. Tuesday, 8 o'clock in the morning for executive action, 9 o'clock for bill hearings, and then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, plan on 8 o'clock for starting the committee on bill hearings. Anyone have anything for the good of the committee? Remember, we have a floor session tomorrow on Saturday. Okay? We are adjourned.